You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. This is part two of seven in that series for 2009.
Let's take a quick look at the map handout. I did not draw these maps. If I drew these maps, these were the best ones that I could find, which is kind of disappointing. If I had drawn these maps, they would have scales. So as map makers would tell you, these are not maps, they're just sketches because they don't have a scale on it. So it's very disappointing. But to give you an idea, if you look on the top map, the distance from Louisa Courthouse, which is in the lower right-hand corner, to Carpenter's Ford, where Sheridan and his men came across the North Anna River, that's about 6 miles. So the reason I want to tell you that is it's easy to lose perspective. And looking at a map like this, it looks like, well, that might only be a couple of miles. Well, it's 6 miles. So this is a huge tract of land that the battle was fought across. So the distance then from Louisa Courthouse to Trevilian Station is about 5. So that's a long stretch of the Virginia Central Railroad then, and the Gordonsville Road that runs just beneath it. Also, the map maker unfortunately didn't label a lot of these roads. So let me tell you so you'll understand in the narrative I'm about to give you. That road that's running almost east-west between Louisa Courthouse and Trevilian Station is the Gordonsville Road. Then to the very west, it splits, you see, and that one road to the bottom goes to Charlottesville. The other one continues on to Gordonsville. That's pretty much Route 33 today. But that's the Gordonsville Road, so you'll hear me mention that a lot. Then look where the Netherland Tavern is. About halfway, well, most of the way from Louisa Courthouse to Trevilian's. Does everybody see that, where the Netherland Tavern is? Okay. That road going from there to Clayton's store, where Sheridan camped, that's the Fredericksburg Road, Fredericksburg Stage Road, or the Fredericksburg Road. The road from Louisa Courthouse to Clayton's store is the Marquis Road, named after the Marquis de Lafayette. Then the road that has Custer going down it, we've called, just for the sake of clarity, I'm not even sure there was a name, but that's called the Nuns Creek Road, for the sake of clarity. Yep, three N's total, N-U-N-N apostrophe S, Nuns Creek. And of course the other problem is the cartographer didn't put the creeks on here. Nuns Creek follows that pretty much just to the south. And that's where Nuns Creek is. Then the second map, the one behind it, is a totally different scale, of course. And this is in that triangle of land that it's in, that's in the very westernmost part of that top map. So there are lots of problems. And if I'd had more time putting the lecture, the talk together, I would have fixed it, and that way I could have copied it and y'all wouldn't be out there scribbling all this stuff, adding it to the map. And I'm sorry about that. But this map is a much smaller scale and is in that triangle of road roadways that's to the west, where the Charlottesville Road goes to the south and the Gordonsville Road continues on, Route 33. Okay? All right. So here we go. As Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer barked out orders, the troopers of his Michigan Brigade quickly dismounted and prepared to fight on foot. Scabbards and canteens rattled together in the warm summer air. Despite the fact that they had captured a large number of enemy wagons, ambulances, and caissons, their immediate situation looked rather grim. Confederate cavalrymen had the 800 Wolverines surrounded, caught inside of what one would later describe as a living triangle. The date was June 11th, 1864, the place, Trevilian Station, Virginia. Churning up the dust as they hustled into position, the Michigan boys rapidly organized their defense. On the eastern side of the encirclement, the cavalrymen faced down the Gordonsville Road to Louisa Courthouse. To the north, they overlooked the tracks of the Virginia Central Railroad. On the western edge, dismounted horsemen hurriedly knelt behind a fence-railed barricade, their seven-shot Spencer carbines bristling over the top in the noonday sun. The brigade wagon train was whipped and shouted into a field to the south. When the Confederates attacked, they seemed everywhere at once. A mounted assault from the west triggered an eruption of Union carbine and pistol fire. The fighting quickly dissolved into small unit actions as further southern assaults smashed against the encirclement and fell back. When a disoriented officer asked Custer loudly if they should hustle the led horses to the rear, the young general shouted back, "Yes, by all means," but then quickly added, "Where in hell is the rear?" The Battle of Trevilian Station was the largest all-cavalry battle of the Civil War. By comparison, the Battle of Brandy Station, fought almost exactly 1 year earlier outside of Culpeper, Virginia, featured more cavalrymen, but had also included two brigades of Federal infantry. Cavalry forces, of course, are highly mobile, so large-scale cavalry actions tend to be wide-ranging affairs, contested across large tracts of land. Trevilian's was no exception. It was fought in Louisa County along a three-mile stretch of the Virginia Central Railroad and the Gordonsville Road, running from Louisa Courthouse to Gordonsville, which parallels the tracks and crosses them numerous times, and along three roads that plunge into the dense woods north of the iron rails, heading toward Carpenter's Ford on the North Anna River, about 6 miles distant. Trevilian Station itself was nothing more than a whistle stop, but the railroad, of course, was invaluable to the Confederacy. It carried foodstuffs from the Shenandoah Valley, the breadbasket of the Confederacy, east to Richmond and the forces arrayed for its defense. At Trevilian's, a large Union raiding force under Major General Philip Sheridan was severely handled, and Little Phil was prevented from reaching his immediate goal, Charlottesville. It was the fourth spring of the war, the end of the first week of June, 1864. Northern forces had made serious inroads into Virginia and were poised for the successful continuance of the struggle. On the coast, Norfolk and Fort Monroe were in Federal hands, as was all of the Old Dominion north of the Rapidan and Rappahannock Rivers and east of the Blue Ridge Mountains. In the Valley of Virginia, Federal Major General David Hunter, Black Dave Hunter, commanding an army of 8,500, had successfully fought the Battle of Piedmont on June 5th and marched triumphantly into the city of Staunton. There he was joined by a cavalry force under Brigadier General George Crook. Northeast of Richmond, the Union Army of the Potomac under Major General George Gordon Meade, with his immediate superior, Ulysses S. Grant, looking over his shoulder, was stalled at the killing ground known as Cold Harbor. Facing Meade's men from behind a network of virtually impregnable breastworks was General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, outnumbered but undaunted. The direct route toward the Confederate capital was blocked, so Grant determined to move his huge army by the left, cross the James River at City Point, approximately, and take Petersburg. In order to accomplish this grand movement, it was desirable to draw off the bulk of the Confederate cavalry. A major diversion was needed. On the afternoon of June 5th, Meade ordered his cavalry commander, Major General Philip Sheridan, to ride to the west and capture Charlottesville. "Destroy the railroad bridge over the Rivanna near that town," read the orders, "and thoroughly destroy the railroad from that point to Gordonsville." The following day, General Hunter was instructed to cooperate. Grant commanded him to cross the Blue Ridge into Nelson County and, moving eastward, thoroughly tear up the Virginia Central until he joined forces with General Sheridan. Once united in Albemarle County, Sheridan and Hunter were to return to the Army of the Potomac outside of Richmond via the James, if possible, destroying along the way the James River and Kanawha Canal. Charlottesville's fate once in the hands of federal officers made infamous during the war by their devastation of the Shenandoah Valley, can only be guessed. New York-born little Phil Sheridan, a small, broad-shouldered, squat man with black hair and a square head, which, incidentally, he always appeared ready to drive through a brick wall, set out confidently on the morning of June 7th. My instructions permitted latitude in the route I should take, he penned in 1888 in his personal memoirs. I decided to march along the north bank of the North Anna River, cross that stream at Carpenter's Ford, strike the Virginia Central Railroad at Trevilian Station, destroy it toward Louisa Courthouse, march past Gordonsville, strike the railroad again at Cobham Station in northeast Albemarle County, and destroy it thence to Charlottesville as we proceeded west. The success of this program would, of course, depend on the location of General Hunter when I should arrive in the region where it would be practicable for us to communicate with each other. Sheridan's raiding force comprised two divisions of horsemen under the command of Brigadier Generals Alfred T.A. Torbett and David M. Gregg, both 31-year-old graduates of the 1855 West Point class. What a coincidence, huh? Torbett's division contained the brigades under Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer, the Michigan Brigade sporting four regiments of Wolverines, Colonel Thomas C. Devon, a force of one Pennsylvania and three New York cavalry regiments, and Brigadier General Wesley Merritt, the Reserve Brigade, so called because it boasted detachments from three regular U.S. cavalry units, the 1st, 2nd, and 5th, supported by a regiment each from New York and Pennsylvania. The two brigades of Gregg's smaller division were commanded by Brigadier General Henry Davies, a polyglot force of five regiments, one each from Massachusetts, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York, and Colonel J. Irvin Gregg, containing five regiments from Pennsylvania and one from Maine. This last-named unit, the 1st Maine Cavalry, was famous for its composition. In the Maine, they were sailors from the seacoast villages. Their colonel, a former seagoing captain, often navigated his uneasy riders using nautical rather than landlubber terminology. Thus, files left was often translated into files port, and mount became board, etc. Sheridan's cavalrymen were accompanied by four batteries of horse artillery with 20 cannon. Each trooper carried 3 days' rations intended to last 5 days and 2 days' worth of grain for his horse. The balance needed for the expedition would be supplied, of course, by the farms of Central Virginia. The jangling column of blue-jacketed cavalrymen rode west from behind the right flank of the Army of the Potomac. The force of 9,200, along with its complement of 125 wagons, took up between 5 and 6 miles of road. Along the route, the Northerners skirmished with small bands of Southern irregulars, but encountered no serious opposition. The hot weather and thick dust, however, soon caused the weaker horses to drop out. In all cases where this occurred, wrote Captain Theophilus Rodenbaugh, the disabled animals were shot and killed by the rear guard. Foraging, official and private, was carried out on an impressive scale. The orders against taking horses from the column, except by permission or by order, were so stringent and so rigidly enforced, wrote the historian of the 1st Maine Cavalry, that private foraging had to be done on foot, which, however, did not prevent it from being done quite extensively. Adventurous and hungry boys would start off in advance of the column in the morning and scour along the line of march as well as they could, leaving their horses to be led along the column by comrades, recompensing the comrades for the trouble of dividing the spoils with them on the return. On the whole, the men did not suffer a great deal from hunger, while many of them lived on the fat of the land. At Childsburg, Sheridan's raiders picked up a road paralleling the left bank of the North Anna River and continued westward. On June 10th, the Federals splashed across the North Anna at Carpenter's Ford and went into camp a short distance beyond near Clayton's store. Now the Federal force is already on that map. Trevilian Station was but a few miles to the southwest, so they're camping there on the night of June 10th. Sheridan planned to strike the Virginia Central at Trevilian's the next morning. Once astride the tracks, his experienced cavalrymen would pry up the iron rails and bend them into uselessness after heating them atop blazing bonfires made up of the ties. In this manner, miles of railroad track could be destroyed within a matter of hours. The station buildings and any Confederate grain warehouse nearby would also be burned. He intended the same destruction for the railroad property at Gordonsville and Charlottesville. What he had not counted on, however, was the reception being planned for him by Confederate Major General Wade Hampton. The son and grandson of well-to-do South Carolinians, 46-year-old Wade Hampton was perhaps the South's wealthiest pre-war plantation owner. Hampton had initially disagreed with the policy of secession, but once South Carolina acted, once South Carolina seceded, noted Douglas Southall Freeman, he put all doubt and argument behind him and placed at the command of the state his wealth and services. He raised and equipped his own force, the Hampton Legion, and led it admirably at First Manassas, where he was slightly wounded. Appointed Brigadier General in May of 1862, he was wounded again at Seven Pines. Hampton was placed in charge of a brigade of cavalry in September of the same year, and by the spring of 1864 had risen to the rank of Major General, commanding the 1st Division of Major General Jeb Stuart's Cavalry Corps. By saying he commanded the 1st Division, that meant he was the second in command after Stuart. Hampton looked a grand military chieftain, wrote Southern cavalryman Edward Wells. Full bearded, tall, erect, and massive, a horseman from lifelong habit and natural aptitude. Despite his abilities, however, along with commendable performances on many a hotly contested battlefield, General Lee, for some reason, hesitated to hand Wade Hampton the golden ring. When Stuart was mortally wounded at Yellow Tavern on May 11, 1864, Hampton, as senior division commander, was not immediately confirmed as chief of cavalry. The Cavalry Corps' three cavalry division leaders were instead ordered to report directly to Robert E. Lee's headquarters. Confederate scouts reported Sheridan's movement to Hampton on the morning of June 8th, a Wednesday. The South Carolinian passed the information on to General Lee and asked that he be allowed to pursue. Lee approved. The 4,400 cavalrymen of Hampton's 1st Division were on the move by daylight of Thursday, June 9th. His preparations were so quick that even his own officers were at first unaware of their destination. The division that took off after Sheridan consisted of Brigadier General Matthew C. Butler's brigade of three South Carolina regiments, technically more akin to mounted infantry units, that had joined the army from the Charleston, South Carolina garrison, a brigade of six Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi units under Colonel Gilbert J. Wright, standing in for wounded Brigadier General Pierce Manning Butler Young, and the famous Laurel Brigade, three Virginia regiments under the command of Brigadier General Thomas L. Rosser. Accompanying Hampton was the Horse Artillery Battalion under Major Roger P. Chu, comprising 14 guns in five batteries and approximately 400 artillerymen. A second division, 1,800 horsemen under Major General Fitzhugh, or simply Fitz Lee, Robert E. Lee's nephew, was ordered to follow. And I know it's kind of complicated, but the reason I wanted to tell you what was in all of these brigades is so you'd hear all the different states represented. That was my main reason for doing that. So most of the states a good number of the states east of the Mississippi, and certainly all the states on the East Coast except for Florida, pretty much were represented at this battle. Hampton's horsemen, aided by a shorter route, pushed on through Thursday and Friday to intercept the Northern raiders. Huge dust clouds were raised by the marching columns, the only relief being the creek water churned muddy by the thousands of passing hooves. On the morning of the 10th of June, wrote John Opie in his fast-paced A Rebel Cavalryman, first published in 1899, the bugle of our regiment blew saddle up, and the report was soon circulated that we were off to the Valley of Virginia, a spot dear to every cavalryman's heart. Of course, we were all hilarious, and soon we were on the road, formed in fours, and moving at a lively pace. On the evening of Friday, June 10th, Hampton reached Green Spring Valley, 3 miles west of Trevilian's, a position well chosen to block any further westward advance by Sheridan. Fitz Lee's smaller division, two Virginia brigades led by Brigadier Generals William C. Wickham and Lunsford L. Lomax, went into camp near Louisa Courthouse, 8 miles to the east. By this time, it was pretty well known among the men that Hampton was seeking Sheridan, wrote Wells, and that a fight was on for the morning. Not content to await Sheridan's next move, Wade Hampton determined to attack on the morning of June 11th. Leaving Rosser's brigade near Trevilian's, Hampton marched north against Sheridan along what's known as the Fredericksburg Road with the brigades under Butler and Wright. So now we're starting to see some of the action on this top map along the Fredericksburg Road. Fitz Lee to the east was ordered to attack simultaneously along the Marquis Road that wound north from the courthouse. Sheridan's two divisions at Clayton's Store would thus be assaulted in front and flank. Yes, sir.
Where did he come up from and what road?
Where did Hampton come up from? You know, I didn't write down his route. But I tell you what, ask me at the end. I brought a recent history, and ask me at the end, and I'll give you the information out of this. They came up out of the Richmond area, yeah. Yeah, north. They came out of northeast of Richmond, right around the Cold Harbor area. Yeah, but I don't have the exact route, but if you ask me again at the very end, I've got one of the standard histories here in my valise, okay? And I'll give you the information. Yep. Okay, that's a good question. All right, we're talking about approximately 90, let's see, the Federals.
92.
Yeah, 9,200. And that doesn't include the artillerymen, so go ahead and add 300 or 400 more artillerymen. So it's more up around 96. Then Hampton's division, which is the larger of the two Confederate divisions, was 4,400. With that was the 400 artillerymen in the Horse Artillery Battalion, and then 1,800 men under Fitz Lee. So in total, we should get something around 96 versus something around 67 or 68. Pretty good disparity. 3-2 odds, pretty much in Sheridan's favor. Hemmed in and crowded together. Let's see, where were we? Sheridan's two divisions at Clayton's Store would thus be assaulted front and flank. Hemmed in and crowded together with a river in the rear, wrote Wells. Sheridan could then be destroyed. And I just want to say something here really quickly. You read a lot of Civil War histories, and you hear a lot of claims about armies being destroyed. And that really never happened. But people have all these wild hopes. Probably the closest an army was destroyed was what Forrest did to a federal army at Bryce's Crossroads, which is really probably the perfectly fought battle by Bedford Forrest. And if you're ever interested in that. But the reason I'm saying this is because I want you to understand that these claims that armies could be destroyed are well nigh ridiculous. That just did not happen. People had high hopes, unless you capture somebody in an encircled city and they surrender to you, like happened at Vicksburg or happened at Fort Donelson. Armies in combat were just not destroyed. A mounted squadron of the 4th South Carolina covered the advance of Hampton's division as it rode through a dense wood. When contact was made with Sheridan's troopers, Hampton dismounted his men and attacked on foot. As the cavalrymen marched forward as infantry, the horseholders, one man out of every four, led the horses to the rear. The ground was well chosen for this purpose, wrote Wells, and the nature of the country along the Fredericksburg Road lent itself admirably to the design. It was thickly wooded and would thus conceal numbers and dispositions and afford the men the advantage of their superior skill as shots, and in this way neutralize to a certain extent the greater effectiveness of the enemy's magazine rifles. He's talking about Spencer's, Henry's. It is a little amusing that federal officers on this and other occasions complained of Hampton as being a woods fighter, as if such tactics were hardly fair play. That they did so, however, is in fact a compliment, and gives evidence of the gift he possessed of detecting at a glance advantages of ground and utilizing favorable positions. I thought that was a great quote. Because so few of the commanding officers on this portion of the battlefield filed official reports, the vicious fighting on the Fredericksburg Road is very difficult to pin down. As can be imagined, the reports that do exist are contradictory. Confederate Trooper Wells, a member of Butler's Brigade, for example, penned a fairly standard Southern version. Following initial contact, he noted, Butler's and Wright's brigades of Hampton's division were dismounted and advancing through the woods on either side of the road, soon struck the enemy and pressed him back, according to the plan. Captain Theophilus Rodenbaum, on the opposite side in this action, in command of the 2nd U.S. Cavalry of the Reserve Brigade, wrote the following. As the leading regiment, 2nd United States Cavalry, took the trot, it encountered a patrol or advance guard of the enemy. This was driven back and several prisoners taken who stated they belonged to the brigade of General M.C. Butler. The Reserve Brigade advanced a quarter of a mile farther when it found the enemy in force dismounted in a piece of timber which extended across the road for some distance. Our cavalry was partly dismounted and the entire 1st Division became engaged. Union Brigadier General Wesley Merritt reported that the enemy was driven through a thick, tangled brushwood for over 2 miles to Trevilian Station, but not without serious loss to ourselves, though we inflicted heavy punishment on the adversary in killed, wounded, and prisoners. Do you see what I mean about the contradictory reports? On the one side, they dismount, they drive the enemy a great distance, just like the plan. In Merritt's report, the Confederates are driven back for 2 miles. It's kind of hard to figure out exactly what's going on here. On Hampton's right, but here's what turned into the most interesting part of the fight. On Hampton's right, Fitz Lee's division was rather ponderous in its movements. Based on his actions throughout the two-day battle, in fact, writers have speculated that Fitz Lee was jealous of Hampton's seniority in the Cavalry Corps and was hesitant to cooperate to the best of his abilities. While he did dispatch a force along the Marquis Road to Clayton's store, and the movement took place prior to daylight, he sent only one brigade, Wickham's. After this force of Virginians captured a 7th Michigan scouting party, they trotted farther northward, apparently intent on the aggressive operation Hampton had ordered. Then they arrived at Nuns Creek, less than 2 miles north of Louisa Courthouse, and a picket line of the 7th Michigan boys on the bank beyond. When Wickham's half-hearted assault resulted in a considerable firefight and federal reinforcements arrived sent by Custer, the Confederate Brigadier General had had enough. He broke off the action and retired back down the Marquis Road to Louisa Courthouse. So much for Wade Hampton's two-pronged envelopment. Fitz Lee's failure to press the attack on the Marquis Road had a major impact on the course of the action. It removed the pressure from George Armstrong Custer, an officer who seemed always itching for a fight. Was it the actual combat he longed for, or martial fame and glory? In both the Civil War and afterwards in the Indian conflict, literally hundreds of troopers died to satisfy Custer's insatiable bloodlust and megalomania. That being said, his was the perfect temperament for an outstanding commander of Civil War cavalry, the branch of the Army that encouraged, indeed trained, its officers to be recklessly aggressive. Nearly 6 feet in height and never weighing over 170 pounds, in other words, wiry, Custer was the prototypical beau sabour. In dress, he looks like a circus rider gone mad, wrote one of his admiring horsemen. And that's an admiring guy, right? He wears a hussar jacket and tight trousers of faded black velvet trimmed with tarnished gold lace. The general's coiffure consists of short, dry, flaxen ringlets. He has very merry blue eyes and a devil-may-care style. That style was never more apparent than at Trevilian Station in June of 1864. Custer's merry blue eyes must have flashed when he discovered that a little-used wood road ran from behind Nuns Creek to the Gordonsville Road in between Louisa Courthouse and Trevilian's. Not only did this lane bisect the two Confederate cavalry divisions, Hampton and Lee's, but it also happened to be completely unguarded by Southern riders. Into this gap dashed Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer at the head of his Michigan Brigade. Within a short ride, Custer's men passed through the shielding woods and found themselves within a mile and a half of Trevilian Station in Hampton's rear. Just southeast of the station sat Hampton's ammunition and baggage train and the division's led horses. Without hesitating, Custer ordered Colonel Russell A. Alger's 5th Michigan Cavalry to charge. In the wild running melee that followed, Alger reported capturing 800 prisoners, 1,500 horses, 6 caissons, 40 ambulances, and 50 army wagons. Unfortunately, the 5th Michigan was overzealous in this chase and later lost all of these prizes and a good number of its own men to a stray regiment of Fitz Lee's division. Some of Custer's squadrons also ranged too far to the west. In response, Confederate General Rosser trotted his brigade down the road leading to Gordonsville and immediately charged with 2 of his regiments in columns of 4s. Custer made a gallant and manly effort to resist me, wrote Rosser. Sitting on his horse in the midst of his advanced platoons and near enough to be easily recognized, he encouraged and inspired his men by appeal as well as by example. When his color sergeant was shot down, Custer tore the headquarters flag from its staff and thrust it into his jacket. The fight was getting hot. George Armstrong Custer, however, was exactly where he wanted to be, the center of attention. Hampton and Sheridan continued to slug it out on the Fredericksburg Road, but the day's most vicious fighting swirled around Custer's position. To the north, Hampton withdrew a part of his division and ordered it back to reclaim Trevilian's. Fitz Lee attacked Custer's brigade from the east, albeit feebly. Custer, without knowing it, struck the road between Hampton and Lee, wrote Roddenbow. When Lee attempted to close up, in other words, move west along the Gordonsville Road, he espied a wagon train, caissons, etc., of Custer's, and obligingly took them under his protection. The spoil included, don't you love this language they use? The spoil included all of Custer's captures, except 200 prisoners, his headquarters wagon, and his colored cook, Eliza, who usually occupied an antique ruin of a family carriage on the march and was called by the soldiers the Queen of Sheba. In one of the fluctuations of the fight that day, fluctuations, in other words, seesaw, fluctuations, the Queen escaped and came into camp with her employer's valise, which she had managed to secure. Rosser's Virginians assaulted Custer's Wolverines from the west and the south. In the middle sat Custer and his 3 remaining Michigan regiments, a force of approximately 800 men. He was surrounded for the first time in his military career. It would not be the last. Nonetheless, Custer and his Michigan boys did a superb job of holding on. The smallness of my force compelled me to adopt very contracted lines, reported Custer, which resembled very nearly a circle. The Southern troopers had Custer pinned down, but they could not overrun him. Undoubtedly, the firepower of Custer's Spencer 7-shot carbines greatly aided in his defense. Even though much of the fighting around Custer's first last stand was undertaken by dismounted men, all of the brigadiers, as was dictated by the manuals, kept large portion of their forces mounted for use in assaults and counterassaults. For this reason, the encirclement combat was fluid, with many back and forth fluctuations. The writer, so here's a really great account, and it's kind of long, but I think it'll be worth it. The writer remembers being halted on the edge of a dense woods, penned Southerner Opie, through which the road from Louisa Courthouse to Trevilian Station ran, and which was being shelled at a lively rate by artillery posted on a hill some 500 or 600 yards distant in an old broom sage field. My company, together with the Rappahannock troop, formed the first squadron of our regiment, and combined, numbering not more than 80 men, received an order to charge and take the battery. Ours not to reason why. At the word of command and with our gallant Major A. Grimsley at our head, our squadron moved rapidly out of the woods and charged with unbroken line and with great rapidity for the guns, which were firing at us grape and canister. The gunners fled upon our approach and left us, apparently, for the moment, victors of the field with the guns in our possession. But down over the crest of the hill, we still pursued the flying artillerymen when suddenly there arose from the tall broom sage and scrubby pines a regiment or more of dismounted men with long-range guns formed in solid line. We hesitated not a moment, but with drawn saber and pistol, we chased at them, we dashed at them, and though at their fire many of our saddles were emptied, the enemy were beginning to yield to the impetuosity of our charge when a regiment of mounted men came dashing from the woods on our flank, and we saw at once that someone had blundered. The rider of this, shot through the bridle hand and through the lung, fell from his horse and was left a prisoner in the hands of the enemy. Unlimbered cannon, less mobile, of course, than soldiers fighting mounted or on foot, frequently became the set pieces around which the cavalry fighting swirled. While moving upon the rear of the Michigan Brigade, wrote Rodenbaum, Fitz Lee's men also espied one of Pennington's guns in a tempting spot. They drove away its slight support and captured the piece, but the limber and most of the artillerymen escaped. Upon reporting this loss, Pennington said he thought the enemy intended to keep it, the cannon, in other words. I'll be damned if they do, responded his irate chief. And collecting some 30 men, Custer led them in person where the gun was being hauled off by hand. Failing in his first attempt, he dismounted every other man of a lot of horseholders nearby and, aided by several mounted staff officers, charged and recovered the gun. Though perhaps several of the Union general officers would have enjoyed witnessing General Custer's comeuppance, the loss of the magnificent Michigan Brigade would have been far too steep a price to pay. Sheridan eventually fought through the Confederate lines to reach the encircled Wolverines. In one huge simultaneous attack, two of Sheridan's brigades forced Hampton's Southerners past Custer's encirclement and reestablished contact. The confused battle of June 11th ended with Hampton retiring west past Trevilian Station. Fitz Lee's division remained outside of Louisa Courthouse, temporarily isolated by Sheridan's possession of Trevilian's and the woods and fields surrounding it. Rain fell the night of June 11th. Fitz Lee used the cover of darkness to circle south of Sheridan and join Hampton at Mallory's Crossroads, over a mile west of Trevilian Station. So now we're on that second map. Here Hampton reorganized the two divisions. Turning over his division to the command of General Butler, Wade Hampton assumed the leadership of the entire Confederate, the direct leadership of the entire Confederate force. His losses had been fairly heavy, but he was still determined to deprive Sheridan of his ultimate goals, the capture of Gordonsville and Charlottesville, and the destruction of the connecting Virginia Central track. From Confederate prisoners, Sheridan discovered this evening that General Hunter had failed to cooperate with the strategic plan. Instead of marching over the Blue Ridge, Black Dave had continued up the Shenandoah Valley to Lexington. The Federal cavalrymen spent the morning of Sunday, June 12th, ripping up the Virginia Central Railroad between Louisa Courthouse and Trevilian's. 3 miles of the line were thoroughly destroyed, reported Sheridan. Ties burned and rails rendered unserviceable. This work accomplished, Sheridan moved west in the mid-afternoon to feel out Hampton's position. The scrappy South Carolinian, however, despite the fact that he had retired after the first day's fight, was more than eager to renew the rather warm acquaintance that had already been established with Sheridan's boys. Deployed between the roads leading to Charlottesville and Gordonsville, Hampton's defensive position was quite strong. Using piled fence rails as the basis for their field works, the Southern cavalrymen had dug in along a line shaped like the number 7. The top bar was formed of Butler's brigade, sheltered behind the Virginia Central Railroad embankment and facing north. The balance of Hampton's force, minus a tactical reserve, fell into the south, facing east. Horse artillery strengthened the Confederate defenses. acting impetuously, Sheridan dismounted his troopers and attacked on foot. Repeated Union assaults slapped against the southern fieldworks. Crouched behind the protective railroad embankment, Butler, South Carolinian, armed for the most part with Enfield rifles, exacted a heavy toll every time the northern horse soldiers advanced. "The reserve brigade went in on the field to the right," wrote Rodenbaugh, "and attacked the enemy's left flank, Butler's position, vigorously. It was slow work, however, and as the enemy was not pressed as forcefully on the left, he concentrated his force on the brigade and by larger numbers and fresh troops gave the command as much as it could attend to." The sixth federal attack was thus described by one of Butler's boys, the sixth federal dismounted attack. "The enemy advanced in force to finish the job. They concentrated on Butler's brigade. One body marched with beautiful precision in close order." Remember, we're talking about cavalrymen fighting dismounted, exactly like infantry, shoulder to shoulder, the carbines held horizontally at the hip and shooting continuously. A few steps in advance strode the leader, and he counted time to keep his troopers in regular step. Somehow, no bullets could hit him, and when any of his men dropped, the rest closed up beautifully and marched straight on. This brave fellow had almost reached the breastwork when suddenly he stopped and he collapsed upon the ground. Immediately his men broke and ran. It was all in vain. As evening approached, Little Phil withdrew from the field and began the long trip back to the Army of the Potomac. He left behind over 200 wounded. Hampton's force was too shaken to immediately pursue. Who won? Both sides claimed casualties of approximately 1,000 killed, wounded, and captured for the two-day battle. 955 Northerners compared to 813 for the two Southern divisions. But of course, Confederate losses were much harder to replace. In the fight itself, in fact, Sheridan suffered casualties totaling 10.3% of his force, while Hampton's ranks lost 12.3%. The first day's fight could rightfully be declared a federal tactical victory, as Custer was rescued from annihilation and the Confederates had withdrawn from the field, but the conflict of June 12th belongs solely to Wade Hampton. Strategically, too, the victory has to be given to the heavily bearded South Carolinian. He handled his force superbly during the raid, outmarching Sheridan in order to get astride the Virginia Central ahead of him, and ultimately denying Little Phil the two railroad towns he was attempting to seize. As a result of the fighting at Trevilian Station, Wade Hampton was soon made Robert E. Lee's chief of cavalry. Sheridan, for his part, had succeeded in drawing away most of the Confederate cavalry while Meade and Grant pulled off their scurry to the left, and the Federal raiders destroyed a few miles of track. But the damage to the Virginia Central was trifling. The rails were quickly repaired, and the rail line very soon back in operation. In the winter of Philip Sheridan's life, in the warm glow of his advancement to four-star general and his years as commander-in-chief of the Army, Little Phil claimed that his Trevilian Station raid had been a success. In his June 16, 1864 report to General Grant, however, Major General Philip Sheridan concluded by saying, "I regret my inability to carry out your instructions." In other words, admitting failure. Confederates, too, had much to say about the Battle of Trevilian Station, and two of the most thought-provoking quotes were uttered by artillerymen. "The Battle of Trevilians," noted Roger Chu, "was perhaps the most important fight of the war, because if lost, General Lee and his whole army would have been without supplies." Trevilians was so important to General Lee that he was enabled thereby, because of the victory, to stay in Petersburg for nearly a year longer. The following comes from the diary of one of Chu's gunners, George Neese, which was later published after much embellishment, no doubt, as 3 years in the Confederate horse artillery. "In these latter days," he supposedly wrote in between Trevilian's 2 days of battle, "it seems that Uncle Sam is depending on and putting his trust in the might of numbers to grind the armies and the rebellious Southland down by sheer attrition and brute force. Consequently, the powers that be at Washington select the commanders for their budding qualities instead of their strategic capabilities." Philip Sheridan may have looked like he was about to drive his head through a brick wall, but at Trevilian Station in Louisa County, he finally encountered a brick wall that would not budge. Thank you. Well, Brandy Station was fought more on horseback than Trevilian Station. It was an evolution in combat, and I really think that by the end of the Civil War, this time and moving forward, they were using the horses more as transportation to get the men quickly there to fight dismounted. It's a matter of range, and this battle really showed off the advantage of mounted infantry. In both actions, Butler's men, which were really mounted infantry, those South Carolinians that came up from Charleston, fought dismounted and did amazingly well with their Enfields. The two-banded Enfield and the regular infantry Enfield, of course, have much longer range. Here's the thing. They've got much longer range than the magazine rifles, the Spencer or the Henry that the Federals were carrying. So the Federals might be able to fire faster, which they did, but they can't fire accurately over a longer distance. And that's one of the things that made a difference with Butler's brigade. Right. A dragoon is somebody we would more likely consider a cavalryman, but a dragoon is a man that's armed as an infantryman and as a cavalryman. So he's got the saber and he's got the dragoon pistol, but he's also got the carbine, so he can fight dismounted. Yep, Ron. Three of the Confederates at this fight in the Spanish-American War became generals of volunteers, and the other one who fought out west was Wheeler. You know, the direct descendant of Wheeler lived here in this town. I got a chance to meet her, and she showed me a bunch of his memorabilia. And he was famous for leading attack in Cuba and saying, "Come on, boys, let's get those damn Yankees." Getting a little confused. What was going on in Cuba? Yep. Well, you know about what ifs. Right. I think it would have made a huge difference. Yeah, I think it could have been disastrous. Hampton would have had to do something different if he had one federal army in front of him and one behind him. It might have been a lot different. But then it's a huge what if. What? Yeah, more than likely, which would leave a huge track of the Virginia Central open to Sheridan to just march along the way. Yeah, it's interesting. What ifs are a lot of fun. Yep. Walt?
How did Hampton get such good intelligence concerning Sheridan's movement back to where he was?
That's a great question. But, you know, any movement in friendly Confederate territory is immediately reported. So the guy who looks like a farmer, you know, in the middle of the night gets on his horse and rides over to headquarters. And I didn't include this, but one of the histories talks about how Robert E. Lee, once he got the intelligence that there was a large force moving out of the back of the Army of the Potomac and headed west, perfectly divined Sheridan's intentions. Perfectly. Now that y'all are asking all these questions and I'm thinking about the stuff that I didn't include, there is a very important piece of information that should have been in the story, and that is that Hampton was senior to Fitz Lee, but only by a few weeks. It was close enough that they could argue about it, but technically, if the two men met on a battlefield, Hampton would be in charge. He just hadn't received the official stamp of approval from Robert E. Lee's headquarters. I know this is going to sound surprising coming from a Virginian, but I'm of the camp that I believe that actually Hampton was probably a better cavalryman than Jeb Stuart was. Yep. Yep. That's in the late afternoon. In fact, this fighting didn't start until about 3 or 4 in the afternoon and then went until dark. It's just that I didn't talk about this extensively because, to me, it's not as interesting. It's a straight infantry assault against men behind an embankment right here, mostly. Over here, if you look on the right of this map, it shows Custer with the regiment. There was a little bit of action over here on the southern reaching part of the Confederate line, but not much. Most of the assaults, and it really, when you get out there and you look at it and you think about it, it really does seem like idiocy. Just kept coming across through that orchard and past the gentry house and right up against that embankment, just like an infantry attack. Yep. Right. Well, they showed up with the new ties and the new rails, and they had by this time in the war, they had extensive work crews. That's what they did. They repaired, they built bridges, they repaired rail lines, and so really it was just a matter of days. I know that sounds amazing, but it's true. So they showed up with new rails because, yeah, the old ones were bent. They showed up with new ties. They laid them. They put them down. And it was rolling again. Isn't that amazing? But, you know, if that's your lifeline, it's pretty important to get that thing fixed right away if that's your lifeline. Yep. Hunter decided to Grant in his orders actually gave Hunter a choice. Grant told Hunter, that he would prefer if he cross over the Blue Ridge, which would have put him in Nelson County around Lovingston, and then march up to Charlottesville, tearing up the track. But that if he found himself too far up the valley when he received the orders, then he could continue on his own program. And so that's what Hunter decided to do. Hunter went up to Lexington, of course, and then burned the Virginia Military Institute, including the Commandant's home and library, which seems pretty senseless, and then came over the Blue Ridge and attacked Lynchburg. And that's where Breckinridge's force was going, to the defense of Lynchburg. And eventually, of course, Early's whole corps was sent there to the defense of Lynchburg. And then Hunter got scared when he realized all of a sudden he was facing a pretty decent-sized force. And he retired back over the Blue Ridge and basically into West Virginia, and that opened up the Shenandoah Valley for Early's raid, which we talked about last month. That's what opened up the Shenandoah Valley for Early's raid. Interesting, huh? Hunter wasn't much of an officer. Yep. Any other questions? Y'all have asked some great ones. What's that? What road? Oh, the route of march? Oh, come on up and I'll show you in the book. Thanks for coming, everybody.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.